We are this morning wrapping up our series on the book of Proverbs. And have you been enjoying that series? Just judging from comments that I have heard over the last 7 weeks after services, this was apparently a very timely and meaningful series for a lot of you. And I'll tell you, as pastors, sometimes when you're planning preaching and you're just, I just hope we're talking about the right things. And time after time after time, God comes through and we talk about the right things. And it shouldn't surprise us to trust God to direct us and show us where to go. He delivers time after time after time. So, but we're wrapping that up this morning, and we've been looking at a host of topics from communication to finances to making decisions. And as I was thinking about how to launch into this final topic today, I was thinking, I was struggling with an introduction, and I thought, thanks to a wise suggestion from my wife, we need hype music. Do you know, everybody knows what hype music is. You've been to a baseball game. You go to a Chiefs game, every batter has their own unique music they walk up to, you know. Go to a football game, high school football games, there's always that one song that teams run into and the crowd's going. And I thought, I couldn't think of a better hype song than this right here. And you can sing along if you want. When you start singing.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? It's a neighborly day in this beautiful
neighborhood. You guys are feeling hyped, right?
A neighborly day for a beauty.
I can sense
that. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? I have always wanted to have a neighbor just like you. I've always wanted to live in a neighborhood with you. So let's make the most of this beautiful day. Since we're together, we might as well say, would you be mine? Could you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor? Won't you please? Won't you please? Please won't you be my neighbor? And so we're neighbors again today. I'm glad to be with you.
Who doesn't love Mr. Rogers? And two things watching that video. Did anybody else wonder what's in the bag? And number two, did he have the same pair of blue shoes that he wore the entire series? Because that was later, and you could tell they were looking a little worn. And if you have not guessed, the topic we're talking about this morning is the sin of gluttony. Thank you, Dave Morgan, for laughing at that joke. I was tossing that around in my head of whether or not I should do that, and I got one good laugh out of that. That's worth it. But no, we're talking about how to be a good neighbor. And what's interesting is I was thinking about this in Mr. Rogers, and the stuff we're going to talk about this morning, you could watch 3 or 4 seasons of Mr. Rogers, and it would probably be a lot more enjoyable and a lot nicer than listening to me, but you would learn all of these lessons from Mr. Rogers, which as an ordained minister, it shouldn't surprise us that he built his show on kind of these principles. But we're going to look at the subject of, or as it's taught, as it's described, I guess, a term that's used nowadays, the art of neighboring. In fact, there's a couple of books that have that title about this lost art of just being a neighbor. As our world has gotten bigger, and as you know, it's interesting, our world has gotten bigger. You look at people's lawns, they've gotten smaller, so houses have gotten closer to each other, but the whole art of being a neighbor has become a lost art. And it doesn't just apply to the people who live next door to us. It applies to everyone we come into contact with. And so we're going to look at what Proverbs has to say to us this morning about this art of neighboring. We're going to take a look at a couple of passages, one out of chapter 3. And then as we come back toward the end, we'll look at a couple of other verses. But I believe that Proverbs has a lot to say to us. And if you look at all of these subjects and topics that we've talked about, in these previous 6 or 7 weeks that they all kind of overlap. And you might hear some things today that you've already heard. You may have even heard them last week, but that's because they're all connected. They're not, you really can't isolate any of these from the rest of them because it's this web of life that we have that we can't live in compartments. So if you hear something that sounds familiar, there's a reason for that. Because Proverbs beats the same drum over and over and over again about the seeking after wisdom. So we're going to look at Proverbs chapter 3 to begin with, starting at verse 27 and then just through the end of the chapter there. Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due, and when it is in your power to do it. Do not say to your neighbor, go and come again. Tomorrow I will give it, when you have it with you. Do not plan evil against your neighbor, who dwells trustingly beside you. Do not contend with a man for no reason when he has done you no harm. Do not envy a man of violence, and do not choose any of his ways. For the devious person is an abomination to the Lord, but the upright are in his confidence. The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous. Toward the scorners he is scornful, but to the humble he gives favor. The wise will inherit honor, but fools get disgrace. So what we see and what we've been discovering throughout this series is that there is a close and direct connection between what we believe and our lifestyle. We can talk long and loud about doctrine and belief and theology, but when it comes down to it, the way we live our lives will tell us a lot more about what we believe sometimes in our mouth. And so we've seen that over and over again. We talked about this a little bit last week about Proverbs coming at the subject, as well as the rest of Scripture, coming up at the subject of living a righteous life. It comes out of this quality that we have in our relationship with God, in our relationship with Jesus. It's not something that we manufacture ourselves. It's not something that comes from within us naturally. It comes from our relationship with God. In this case, talking about neighboring, there was a communal life in the Old Testament among the people of God, the people of Israel, where they were responsible for each other and each other's property. And we see that carry over into the New Testament. If you remember at the beginning of the year, we talked about this whole why church matters, and we looked at the early church in Acts about how they cared for each other and they provided for each other. But in the New Testament, you kind of see that even expand farther, because Paul says, do good to everyone, especially those who belong to the house of the Lord. So Paul in the New Testament is saying, all of these things that we're going to talk about today, those aren't just for those who are in, those are for everybody. This is how we are to treat everyone. In John, in 1 John 3:16, it says this, by this we know love, that he, Jesus, laid down his life for us. We ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. But if anyone has the world's good and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us love, Little children, let us not love in word and talk, but in deed and in truth. So what we see is the measure of our faith, the measure of our commitment and connection to Jesus Christ is really measured in how we love one another. Jesus has set a precedent for those of us who have trusted our lives to him. He laid down his life when it was inconvenient, and I don't know that there's a convenient time to lay down your life for someone. When he was criticized and crucified, when he could have gone to war, he laid down his life. He calls us to do that same thing. He served in situations where it took him out of his regular plan of action and had to distract himself sometimes in order to love, in order to be there for people. And he shows us that love is not a sentiment, it's not an emotion, it's not just a feeling, it's an action. It's a verb. So a song by DC Talk from my teenage years that was called Love is a Verb. And that's what we're talking about here. And as we look at our scriptures for today, we can see four different pieces, four different qualities of being a good neighbor. Three will come out of the passage that we just read, and then we'll come back on the fourth one and take a look at a different passage. The interesting thing about this first passage that we look at is that it will give us a command, and it gives us a context within which that command is being addressed. But I have a feeling that if we were to ask Solomon, he would say, well, I didn't just mean for you to live this way in this situation, but these are specific situations in which you could carry this out. And so the first one we see there is found in verses 27 and 28. It says, do not withhold good from those to whom it is due, when it is in your power to do it. Do not say to your neighbor, go and come again. Tomorrow I will give it when you have it with you. So the first principle here is, be helpful. Scholars understand that verse 27 a couple of different ways. Literally, it reads, do not withhold good from its owners. In other words, pay what is owed. Pay if you have something that you owe to someone, make sure you pay it. In those days, laborers were paid on a daily basis. So at the end of the day, they would get their wages to buy food or whatever they needed for the day or the next day. If a man has worked for us or a person has worked for us and we owe them money, we need to give it. The other way that Bible scholars understand this, and probably the first thing that comes to mind when we read this, is not to withhold help from a needy person when we have the means to meet the need. It teaches the general idea of being generous with what we have with our neighbors. That's an interesting verse because the question comes to mind, especially in today's age, is to whom is help due? Who deserves our help? And that's a good question, considering the fact that there are two groups of people in Scripture that Scripture kind of tells us to be aware of, and in some cases even avoid, and that's the sluggard and the leech. And interestingly enough, both of those terms show up in the book of Proverbs. The sluggard is the person who can work but doesn't, and chooses to live off of other people. The leech, very similar, possibly could work, but doesn't. And just like a leech, sucks the life out of whoever they've attached themselves to. And so that's a legitimate question to ask. To whom is help due? Who are we called to give help to? Scripture addresses this group that we're looking at in verse 27 when it says, those who deserve it. And what it means there are those who need help. They're not proud that they need help. And in many cases, they won't even ask for help. They don't expect you or me to bail them out, but they need help. But either way, we're encouraged to not fail in doing good to others. We're to be helpful to people in need. And verse 28 stresses doing it immediately and quickly. The emphasis is not just on immediately meeting the. It's not just on immediately meeting the need when we see it. It's meeting the need when we know we have the means to do so. That's another important principle. We need to know what we can do and when we can do it, and when God moves on us to do so, we need to be prepared to act when the opportunity arises. In the story of the Good Samaritan, the condemnation of the priest and the scribe is not just that they didn't help the man who had been beaten. It was that they didn't do it when they saw the need when they walked by. So there's kind of a double condemnation there. They could have come back and helped. But the key was, at the end of the story, the Samaritan saw the man in need. He had pity on him, took action immediately, picked him up, and we know the rest of the story. Take a look at there, building on that, acting immediately. Do not say to your neighbor, come back tomorrow and I'll give it to you when you have it with you already. How many times have we been approached by someone who's asked us for assistance or asked us for help, and we say, I can't help you today, but come back tomorrow, with no intention that they would ever, or maybe even with a hope that they don't come back and ask me again. If I push them off now, maybe they won't come back and ask me for help. We could have helped. We should have helped. We had the means to do so, but we didn't. When we have the ability to help our neighbor, and we need to allow the Lord to use us to benefit them in a positive way, We shouldn't delay or put it off because of laziness or apathy or inconvenience. So the first principle there is be helpful. The second principle, in the first section, we see the context is a person in need. In the second section of our scripture today, we see how we are to respond to our neighbor who trusts us. So just your next door neighbor who you get along with, who there's no issues with, Solomon has something to say about that too. The neighbor's not necessarily in need. They're minding their own business. They're just a good neighbor. And in this case, to put it one way, we are to be good. Or to put it another way, we're to be peaceful. A wise person not only looks for opportunities to do good, but they also plan to intentionally do good to people. We looked at this a little bit last week, the contrast between the man who devises, the wicked, worthless man who is constantly devising ways to do evil, and the righteous person who is looking for ways to do good and maybe even inventing new ways to do good. This is the idea that we're looking at here. Some translations, when it says to not plan to do evil, will use the word plot instead of plan. And the idea there is of a farmer plowing his field in these straight, calculated rows. He sat down, he knows, I need to get from this point to this point, and he's, you know, if you've ever done a garden and you've marked out your garden and stuff like that, that's the idea. Someone who intentionally, methodically sits down and says, I'm going to do this. Do not intentionally devise evil against your neighbor, but plan to do good. To act maliciously toward our neighbor is to break the trust that they've placed in us. But a person who is seeking to do good doesn't just seek to do good for the sake of doing good. They also are intentionally seeking ways to keep peace. We talked about this a little bit last week too. Paul lists the qualifications of a pastor in 1 Timothy 3, and one qualification that disqualifies a man from being an elder is that he is a brawler. There's a lot of brawlers in here, I know. Every time I see a brawler, I think of one of those old boxing pictures. That wasn't very menacing, was it? But it refers to a person who's contentious, a person who's always causing, stirring up trouble. Jude 3 tells us to contend for the faith, but we're to do it without being antagonistic or argumentative. Proverbs is saying the same thing. Don't act maliciously toward others and don't pick fights with people. Be a person of peace. Peacemakers release tension. They don't build tension. They don't add to the chaos, if you remember that phrase. Peacemakers calm the waters. They don't trouble them. Peacemakers work hard to keep an offense from occurring, and if one has occurred, they work to resolve the issue. One of the strongest qualities that Jesus had was that of a peacemaker. Now, he didn't always cause peace wherever he went, but that wasn't because he wasn't seeking peace. And he might not have been seeking a peace that the people thought of as peace. When he was crucified, he didn't go to war, he forgave. The man of war comes with a sword, but the man of peace disarms him and beats the sword into a plowshare. Paul advises us that as far as it is possible with us to live with peace, to live at peace with all men. This section makes very clear that we're not to take advantage of our neighbors. We're not to plot harm on them. Plotting harm is the opposite of doing good. It means to manipulate, use, hurt, harm, or burden. To do good means that we are relating to others in a way that works to their advantage, regardless of what it does for us. For the Christian business person, that means that you don't take advantage of your customers. You don't sell them things that you know they don't need. You don't hike the prices in the midst of a crisis. And you deal honestly with the people that you do business with. For those of us who live in a neighborhood, it means when you borrow your neighbor's tools, you return it in a timely manner in the condition that you you took it in. Or if something has happened, you make that right. If you borrow the truck or borrow their truck, even if there's a a half a tank of gas when you borrowed it. You put a full tank of gas in the truck. And there's some trucks with some big tanks. Being peaceful means seeking after good and even beyond the good that we would naturally normally do ourselves to be a blessing to our neighbors. This is where the idea of hospitality comes in. I could have gotten to the end of this and somebody would have said, you didn't mention hospitality. This is where, because that's one of the first things that comes to mind when we think of being a neighbor is being hospitable. But this is where this idea of hospitality comes in. Have them over for dinner. Take them dinner. Bake them cookies. This is a, and this is one that hits home for me because I'm a passive neighbor. I'm not a rude neighbor. I'm a friendly neighbor. I'll say hi, but I'm a passive neighbor. That's just, and this, of all of the principles here that we've looked at, this was the one that kind of jabbed me in the side the hardest because I know I don't actively seek good. I don't seek ruin for my neighbor. That wouldn't do any good for me. It'd just make my life miserable, it'd make their life miserable. But are we actively seeking the good of those, not just who live next door, but those who we come into contact with every day? So be good, be peaceful. The third, and in general for all of us, this might be the most difficult because of the context, because of the time that we live in, and because of the fact that we just talked about being peaceful, but be just. This command is not as direct as the other do not commands. In those first two, we have very clear do not take advantage of your neighbor, do not plot harm or evil against them. But we can still see it very clearly here. We're told to not envy the violent. The violent person is one who would hurt another to gain some advantage if they had the opportunity to do so. But a person can be violent and not be physical. They can gossip, they can chat or cheat, they can lie, they can steal their way to the top. In some translations, this person is called devious or perverse. It says, do not envy a man of violence and do not choose any of his ways, for the devious person is an abomination to the Lord. But the upright are in his confidence. The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous. Toward the scorners he is scornful, but to the humble he gives favor. To the wise will inherit honor, but fools get disgrace. So those first couple verses that we see there, it's a contrast between the unjust and the just. The destiny of the house, or at the end of that passage, the destiny of the house of the wicked is to be cursed. The destiny of the man who does right is blessing. God will mock the unjust and the wicked. The righteous and just will be given a greater blessing of God and his goodness. The wicked will be displayed for the foolish person he is, but the wise will get what they didn't seek, honor. An employer who's not concerned with this in his business among his employees might see it hurt him in the bottom line. Parents who don't seek to be fair and just with their children but play favorites, they can expect rebellion. A husband who bullies his wife and children to get his way, he will suffer. A nation with choked courts is a nation that is missing the blessing of God. There is a difference between punishment and justice. And sometimes what we feel is justice is nothing more than retribution and punishment. And the people who are seeking retribution and punishment are the people that God, that the author of Solomon is addressing here with addressing them as the perverse, devious man. The person who's not interested in justice, he's not interested in things being made right, he's just interested in getting ahead and doing damage. People who are wise in the ways of God when it comes to relationships will do everything in their power to be just with others. In this section, we are offered wisdom as to how to deal with a violent neighbor. First, it tells us not to envy them. You ever been envious of the violent neighbor that you've had? That seems like something that should go without saying. But sometimes that violent person is the person who seems like they have everything. And we look at them from the outside and we'll think, well, if I would just do this, maybe I would have this. And it's a very important lesson. We can't judge a man by what's in his house or in his yard or what he possesses, but we can judge them by the character of their heart, by how they carry themselves. We all know this violent person. We encounter them either in our own neighborhoods or in our lives. They're mean. They don't like it when kids walk across their yard. I'm sorry if you don't like it when kids walk across your yard. When we had been told beforehand when we moved into the house on Parliament by Scott and Ann that don't be surprised if you have guests. There's a lot of neighborhood kids and they are always playing up and down the street and I don't think they knew that there was somebody in the house quite yet when we had moved in and there was three or four boys out front playing soccer and I was fine with that, but they had hit one of the basement windows with the ball, with the soccer ball when I was down there, and I just happened to look out the window, and one of them saw me. And you know, I mean, we've all been kids, we all know the look when you think you've been caught. I was just looking to see where they were, if they were passing through, and I wasn't. And I realized after I closed the blinds, because it was one of these, that I'm that guy who doesn't want the kids running through his yard. And being a passive neighbor, I did not go out and tell them, no, you guys are okay, you can play in our yard. I could have done worse. I could have gone out and chased him out of the yard. So, but we all know this person. We know this guy who, they don't wave at anybody when they're, you know, they scowl at you when you drive down the street. You backed out a little too close to their drive or their part of the sidewalk. They grumble, they complain about everything. We're not to be jealous of that person. That would be the neighborhood bully. And it may appear that people walk on eggshells around them, and in some cases, rightfully so, and that he always gets his way, but as we saw last week, unless he changes his course, his destination is calamity. And it will come. And it will come suddenly. That's not something to revel in. I'm not telling you that so that you can sit back and just wait for their demise. But we're to serve that person. We're to seek justice. We're to seek good. We're to seek peace with those, even those people. And we're told that God detests that way of life, that perverse neighbor. But we're also told that God takes into his confidence those who walk with him, those who are upright. It's very easy to fall into that same trap of being that same person that we're despising if we're not careful. God honors the just. He honors the upright. He blesses those who seek after him. The highest calling we have in our relationship with God is to love one another, to be a blessing. For people who make that the aim of their life, God promises to draw near to them. In verses 33 through 35, we see that. The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous. Toward the scorners, he is scornful, but to the humble, he gives favor. The wise will inherit honor, but fools get disgrace. Instead of peace, security, and joy, the house of the wicked is filled with chaos, insecurity, and unrest. You may have all the toys in the world and a bulging bank account, but you'll never experience the peace and security and joy that come from being a person of peace, from being a good neighbor, when God's hand of blessing is on you. So be helpful, be good, peaceful, be just. And fourth, we see in Proverbs 11:17, a man who is kind benefits himself, but a cruel man hurts himself. 14:20 tells us, whoever despises his neighbor is a sinner, but blessed is he who is generous to the poor. be kind, where being just might be the most immediately difficult for us to do, I think sometimes being kind can be tricky. To be cruel is to be intentionally hurtful. To despise someone is to hold them in contempt, to treat them as worthless, or even worse, to not care what happens to them at all. You ever thought about contempt that way? I think we tend to think about contempt of being lashing out and wanting to hurt someone. Dallas Willard, and I think it was in the Divine Conspiracy, defines contempt as not caring at all what happens to someone. And that can be a worse place to be in. It's not just that I want to hurt you. I don't care if you're hurt. I don't care if something good happens to you. I don't care one iota for anything about you. Which would you prefer to be surrounded by? Kind, generous people or cruel, hurtful, spiteful people? What type of person seems to be one that you would rather be? A cruel, hurtful, spiteful person or a kind, generous person? We have to guard against a spirit that causes us to be cruel or despise our neighbor. This can go back to that where we talked about being just, where justice can easily slip into something where we're just trying to get one up on somebody. And it can couch itself in justice, and we can describe it that way, but really it's just cruelty. One of the greatest movies of all time that I remember vividly watching in the sixth grade when we read the novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, has there are multiple scenes that stick out, but one probably this one sticks out to me because of the fact that when I was that age, and I was about the age of the Jem and Scout, the kids in the movie, was that being a shy kid, this encounter that happens, would have been something that, number one, I would not have done near what Scout does in this scene. But I can imagine an old woman sitting on their porch scaring the daylights out of me, especially if somebody told me that she had a Confederate pistol on her lap and she'd shoot me just as soon as look at me. But we know the scene. If you've seen, how many of you have seen the movie To Kill a Mockingbird? Enough of you, okay, so this, I'm not talking to one person. But the scene is I believe it's a certain time of day, and Atticus, the father, is coming home from the courthouse. He's a lawyer, and he's walking down there. He's coming down the sidewalk. They see him in the distance, and the kids are going to run to meet him, along with Dill, this nephew of a neighbor. And there's an old woman that lives next door, Miss DeBose, crotchety old woman. This is the mean neighbor who doesn't like kids running through her yard. And Jem, the brother, tells the other two kids, you know, don't talk to her, don't even look at her. She's got a pistol on her lap and she'll shoot you. And Jem, being the, if you've seen the movie, you know, or Scout, being, you've seen the movie, you know the character. She's going to test the waters. And she walks by and she greets Miss DeBose, but in a way that Miss DeBose does not appreciate, and she says, you come back here, you ugly girl, you don't talk to me like that. And about that time, Atticus walks down the sidewalk and meets them. I'm going to do it. This is my best Gregory Peck impersonation. Why, Miss DeBose. That wasn't very good. I'm just going to say the line. Says, good afternoon, Mr. Bowes. My, you look a picture this afternoon. Behind his back, Jem says he didn't say a picture of what. And Atticus smacks him. Says, my goodness gracious, look at your flowers. Have you ever seen anything more beautiful? Mr. Bowes, the gardens at Bellingrath have nothing to compare with your flowers. And Mr. Bowes's demeanor changes, and she goes, well, I don't think they're quite as nice as they were last year. And we see in that scene this principle played out. I don't think Scout was intending to be cruel. I don't think she was intending to go tit for tat with this crotchety old lady sitting on the porch. But we see in contrast there this attitude of Scout that says, I'm going to poke and prod and get what I can out of this old lady, and I'm going to test to see if she's just as mean as everybody says she is. And then we see this kindness that we see over and over again throughout the movie of Atticus Finch. And he just calmly addresses the neighbor. It could have been a matter of age. She called her an ugly little girl, you know. But we see later on in the movie that Scout has caught this lesson as we see her gently and kindly accept the scariest man in the neighborhood, Boo Radley. That's an exceptionally moving scene. If you see him come out from behind the door in the bedroom, there you are, Boo. Be kind. Some situations that we get ourselves into or that we think we're getting ourselves into, sometimes that we cause ourselves, if we would just be kind. This is likely one of the most difficult qualities when you're in the moment to carry out. Because everything around us tells us, no, you do just exactly to them what they did to you. Be kind. Just be nice. I know it's a fictional account, but in that day and age, that probably was not an unusual thing, and wouldn't be surprised if that was an actual experience that Harper Lee may have written about that she could have experienced in her own childhood. Walking down the street in the South probably would not have been an unusual event for an old woman to have a Confederate pistol sitting on her lap. Be kind. And when you see someone else being kind, take note. Learn that lesson. I think Atticus Finch is one of the greatest characters. There's debate on different things about him, but the kindness and the warmth. He was a neighbor. When the danger comes and the dog, you know, the rabid dog, that's a dark scene. He takes care of the rabid dog. But he takes care of those around him. He's kind. He's warm. And when he's put into situations that put him in danger, he is still kind. The steps of the courthouse, in the courthouse, when he's called on to defend a man who nobody else, probably anywhere in any of those states in the South, would have defended. He's kind. Be kind. Kind is one of the best descriptors of Jesus. Despite people's social condition, leper, woman, Gentile, child, Jesus treated them with respect and dignity. Despite the way that people treated him, he was falsely accused. He didn't seek revenge. He treated them with kindness. What gained the world's attention about the early church was not this militant taking over. You read some of the secular writings about when, you know, the leaders and the rulers of that time were trying to figure out what to do with this new group. Behold how they love one another. That was one of the descriptions. They take care of each other. And they take care of those who don't belong to them. These people are crazy. But the kindness of the early church and the generosity of the early church is what set them apart. They modeled Christ's kindness, and it changed the ancient world. We're strange creatures because we take pride sometimes in telling it like it is, and yet we think in doing that we're being kind. We find all sorts of justifications for doing things to people and those around us, maybe not even externally. Sometimes we do it inside. We don't even let it out. But we couch it in terms like justice and this is for their own good. But when we look at the model that Christ gives us, and when we look at this model that the book of Proverbs gives us, is that really what it is? A man came to Jesus and asked, what's the most important commandment? Jesus answered, it is to love God with everything you've got. and to love people as you love yourself. The man struggled to believe that God actually loved Romans and Gentiles. So he asks, "Who is my neighbor?" Jesus answered by telling a story. A man was traveling from Jericho to Jerusalem when thieves jumped him. They robbed him and nearly beat him to death. A priest refused to interrupt his schedule and help the man. A scribe refused to sacrifice some of his money to help the man. But a despised Samaritan was willing to alter his busy schedule and sacrificially give out of his substance to meet the man's need. Jesus asked the narrow-hearted Jewish leader, who in the story loved like God and was a neighbor to the injured man? The questioner said it was the Samaritan. Most of us profess to be Christians. We love God. The book of Proverbs asks us, where is that evidence? Where's the evidence that we interrupt our daily lives when it's inconvenient for us to be good and be kind and be peaceful? Where's the evidence that because of our love for God, we seek peace with others? If we love God, then where's the practice of practicing kindness? Where's the evidence of practicing kindness rather than being vengeful or negligent? The worship team is going to come and we're going to sing a closing song. Love one another. Seek the best for those around you. Give when you have the opportunity and the means to give. Help when you're called upon to help. Serve when it's inconvenient. Be a good neighbor.